You ever think about how cool it would be to record our podcast in space?
No, it's a vacuum. There's nothing for the vibrations from your voice to move through, so you can't record or hear sound in outer space.
Well, okay, Mr. Killjoy. Let's consider something like more down to Earth. What if we could host our show at the end of the rainbow?
Well, listen, Leprechaun. A rainbow doesn't actually exist in one place. It's made by sunlight and water droplets. There's no physical end to it. It's just light bending and reflecting in the air.
Oh, use your imagination. How about if we broadcast our podcast from the North Pole?
Well, maybe in specialized gear, but if the wind picks up, heat is removed from the body much faster, and hypothermia will set in maybe within 15 minutes, so we'll be frozen by the end of the show.
Fine. Let's just record in your basement.
I guess, but that's no fun.
Hey guys, I thought we were recording in the International Space Station this week.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
I don't know when they're going to be able to get me back.
This is Houston, say again, please.
Help!
Houston, we've had a problem.
I miss her!
Roger, main beam interval.
I never, ever saw him again.
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Lord, you! Christmas last forever.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! Darn it, Kelsey!
We are the wild and pretty guys!
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
And we are the Festive Foreign Film Fans! Well, Mark!
Hi, Bob.
I have to tell you, I know we just kicked off our fourth season, but I've kind of been thinking about last season. Here's the deal. I think there's something that we discussed from last season that we got to carry over to
the Raggies?
Well, Mark, I've been making those. My God, my freezer is full of those things.
Oh.
I want us to borrow that concept from the Philippines, and we have to recognize the 100 days of Christmas. This would start on September 16th, 2026. Don't you think this would be a way to build some positive festive energy?
I think we could be influencers, Bob, because that's what I want to be.
That's all we've ever wanted to be, and no one ever lets us.
No one's interested in our opinion.
Now, we don't have to make every day a major event. We just have to remind ourselves that Christmas is getting closer. So the countdown would start on September 16th, and the excitement would build from there. There might be some people that say, September, a little early for Christmas? Maybe. Are we going to let that stop us? Not at all. We're going to take this countdown serious. And what I want to know from you, Mark, you got any ideas of things that we could do to mark these days, this 100 days?
How about 100 beers of Christmas? You know, I'm always going to default to that. I mean, I could do 100 beers.
That's just a given. We're going to do the 100 beers, but we have to try some other new things.
Do you have any ideas?
I have some. Like, I think for day 97, we could do crank Christmas calls. So we'll randomly dial a number, and then we'll just say Merry Christmas to a random stranger. When they act confused, we'll act confused. That could be really fun, don't you think?
Yeah, sure. I think it'd be very confusing.
So what else can we do, Mark?
How about day 84, we do the movie pitch. We each have to make a pitch for a holiday movie in 60 seconds. We both will secretly write down 20 classic elements of a Christmas film and put them into a hat. Things like a small England town, struggling local bakery, estranged twins, awkward misunderstanding, light a gazebo, Greedy Corporation, Santa-like character, and we each select five and have to put them into a plot. And we go back and forth until we're all gone and our families vote on the winner. Hallmark will produce the movie.
Wow. You know what's so funny is when you named all those elements, I'm like, can I have all of those in my movie?
Well, most Hallmark movies do.
Ooh, I like that one. I was thinking another one we could do,
okay.
Say on the 58th day of Christmas, we have to compose 46 more verses for the 12 days of Christmas. So it finishes up on the 58th day of Christmas. So after 12, we have to go 13, 14 and up from there. What do you think?
On the 58th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me.
What? Of course, you're going to have to sing it all.
Oh, my gosh. I'll just warm up a little bit, take a little bit of honey and whiskey, and I'll be fine. I like it. 12 days is not nearly enough.
Not nearly enough. I agree.
Well, how about this? On day 63, we have a whole thing about threat level.
Okay.
Everybody knows about threat level. We announce an updated Christmas threat level all day on Facebook with absolutely no explanation. Green, Christmas remains distant. Blue, scattered festive thoughts reported. Yellow, Mariah actively increasing. Orange, Hallmark movies are operating at full capacity. Red, Amazon boxes accumulating. DEFCON clause, seek shelter immediately.
I just want to put that on a t-shirt and walk around with it.
I think people who know us would not even be fazed by this. They'd be like, oh my God, what are they up to now?
They'd see us coming and seek shelter immediately. Day 51, how about Christmas court? Where we put a Christmas character on trial, say we could pursue the Grinch for burglary. We could go after Kevin McAllister for child vagrancy. Or how about Santa for breaking and entering?
I love it. Like those mock trials we used to do in school. Yeah, why not? How about day 49, bad Christmas advice hotline? We ask our listeners to submit holiday problems and you and I provide spectacular 4F solutions.
So that's why they named bad Christmas advice. I get it. I get it.
I get it.
Oh, we could do that easy. We're dispensing bad advice all the time.
Constantly.
Now, this one I thought of, we're taking an existing game and modifying it. So day 37, six degrees of Santa. So one of us has to pick a celebrity and we have to try to connect that celebrity to Santa in six steps or fewer.
I like that. The heck with Kevin Bacon.
Let's connect Kevin to Santa.
Yeah. All right. How about day 26, a preparedness drill.
Ooh.
We have to randomly yell Christmas wherever we go that day. Whoever gets the most outburst or is arrested wins.
Oh, my gosh. I love that one. I do that randomly anyway.
Did you ever do this when you're out Christmas shopping? Did you ever, like, pick up some rando, weird-looking thing and turn to someone and say, do you think my wife would like this?
Mark, this is the second shopping game we've heard from you, starting with running up to your wife at a grocery store going, what do you use this for?
What do you use this for? It's really a lot of fun. And it doesn't even have to be at Christmas time. It could be any time. The best one my friend Joe ever did, he went grocery shopping and Joe picks up the National Enquirer. He's like, oh my God, UFOs have been spotted in six cities. Ma'am, do you know about this? Are you aware? This lady was like, she literally just looked at him and took five steps back and went to the next line. It's hilarious to do. Just randomly ask people odd questions.
This is kind of a game for day 19. We could do a Christmas draft where we draft the ideal Christmas, but we do it fantasy football style. So we'll pick a favorite Christmas food or a movie or a gift or character and try to build the best Christmas day.
Well, that's kind of fun. I like that. I could do that.
What would be interesting is like how you then determine who ends up with the better event.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're getting close now to the countdown. Day 10, we do as seen on TV. We need to create some awful as seen on TV gifts like the Euro Club, a golf club that was a portable urinal, the Flowbee, the legendary vacuum-powered hair-cutting system, or the Shake Weight, the oscillating dumbbell with its unintentionally suggestive workout motion. You have one of those, don't you, Bob?
Of course I do. I got to build up both of my hands.
I could tell. Handshake.
What I'm just loving, though, did you ever hear of the Euro Club?
No.
Someone grabs your club and goes, wait, this one feels warm.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, we have to top it all off on day one, the make it real. We're going to do a polar plunge into the beautiful Fox River.
The chilliness and the polluted river just sounds inviting.
It's our local river to our listeners that it looks like liquid mud.
Fair assessment.
So feel free to join us on Christmas Day as we take our polar plunge. Well, Mark, it would be irresponsible of us as professional Christmas podcasters not to count down the 100 days until Christmas. If there's one thing that we have proved at all that we are good at, it's using holidays as an arbitrary reason to drink beers. We know how to waste time, and we do a very good job at it, and no one seems to recognize what a skill that is. Christmas only gets one day a year, which really doesn't seem fair. So I think we just got to use these ideas and to squeeze every ounce of joy out of it. Christmas!
You scared me.
Yeah, practicing. So, Mark, you know us. When there's a challenge in front of us, when history calls, someone needs to respond, especially those with questionable judgment. Think about it. No one has asked for us. No one thinks that we're qualified. None of it matters. And it's because we don't have anything more important to do. We have to step up because we are available. Let the record show that with absolutely nothing at stake, and when no one cares, we answer the call. I mean, most people will go about their day completely unaware that this milestone of 100 days until Christmas has occurred, but we pledge to change that for all of America, or at least we'll change it for our very tolerant wives. You're very welcome, humanity.
Absolutely. And you know what? I'm telling you, I'm really motivated. I think I am going to try to think of more additional crazy things to do when you're out in public. Guys, just use your imagination. It's so fun. Just ask stupid questions or crazy questions. But you got to look serious. I can't laugh about it when you do it. So far, I've had no one take a swing at me. I've had strange looks. I had people back away from me.
I just love your friend. Oh my gosh, we've sighted UFOs.
I mean, he's yelling this in the line.
Well, Mark.
Yes.
Now you've given me something to think about while I'm going with both of my shake weights. I'll have a lot to think about.
You're going to think about me when you're doing your shake weights?
No. Don't think about these games.
Oh. But before we get started and have to move on to 99 more days of nonsense, we need to return to Venezuela for a hot minute to discover what is happening in the Lake Maratibo River basin there. It's lightning, lots and lots of lightning over and over again. Mother Nature puts on its own light show, and sailors have relied on the glow for centuries as a natural lighthouse.
I wonder why. What causes that?
For hours after dark, lightning flashes almost continuous. I wonder if it has to do with like the cold sky and the hot basin. I don't know. During the most active periods, you can see 20 to 30 flashes every minute for 10 hours on over 300 nights each year, making it the place where the most lightning strikes on Earth.
I tell you, get your big feet marching and head to Venezuela.
Yeah, no wonder those big animals died, those rodents.
Hit by lightning.
But if you knew about the Beacon of Maratibo, you could move in the speed and determination of a midnight raid and extract our 4F sticker like a special ops team member on a mission. Swiftly, decisively, and before anyone else knows you're a winner, that little sticker never stood a chance. All right, so tonight, we are going to go to Wayne's. We are actually going to review two movies with the same movie title. What I always do is I Google it. And so I watched this movie, then Bob gave me the DVD, and then I watched the DVD that Bob gave me, and it wasn't the movie that I watched. So I said, hey, Bob, we got a problem. But actually, it wasn't a problem because we take problems and make them into apple juice, lemonade, or something.
Some crazy juice.
Yeah, some crazy
juice. Which we won't drink because it's not beer.
Yeah, it might be good for us.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
So tonight we're going to review two movies, and I'm going to refer to them in two different ways. I'm going to refer to one as the movie and the other one as the comedy. The comedy, let me tell you who stars in that. Ruth Jones is the mum. Ruth Jones was born in South Wales in 1966. She studied drama at Warwick University, where she trained as an actress at the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. One of her earliest screen roles was in the BBC series Fat Friends, where she met James Corden.
Not that we're saying that they're fat friends. We're not saying that.
No, not at all. Together, they went on to create and write the award-winning BBC hit Gavin and Stacey, in which Ruth also played the infamous Nessie Shaughnessy Jenkins. She then founded Tidy Productions and co-created the show Stella for the Sky One network, which ran for six seasons. She's written several of the episodes and played the lead role, along with her television writing credits, which includes another eight-part Apple TV comedy called The Choir with James Corden. She's also written two short stories for radio, a radio play, four novels that have sold over a million copies and are all Sunday Times bestsellers.
What is amazing to me is how talented and productive she has been, but she plays kind of a goofy character. Did you ever see her on Gavin and Stacey?
No.
I watched their Christmas episodes. The show is hilarious, and she's hilarious in that role. And she kind of plays a similar role here.
She's hilarious in this. And then the other actor in the comedy, Mark Lewis Jones, plays the dad, also a Welsh actor who is mostly known for his stage work. His debut was in London with the Royal Shakespeare Company at Shakespeare Globe Theater. His start in films was in 1985, and he went on to work in films such as Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, which starred Russell Crowe, and in Star Wars, The Last Jedi. He's also had many roles on television, including on Game of Thrones and The Crown. He's also a marathon runner who finished the marathon Das Sablas in the Sahara Desert and the inaugural Wales Marathon. He also took part in the Ironman competition in Wales, where he raised money for Head for Change, which provides for education, care, support, and potential treatments in rugby.
What is fascinating, he doesn't look to me like an Iron Man. What I loved about him in this role, he's like the quintessential dad. He just sits on the couch and just got his bemused smile, you know?
I mean, the other person I throw out there who is Uncle Caldwell is Paul Kay. Paul Kay, he was a mainstay for at least, I'd say at least 15 or 20 episodes on Game of Thrones. Oh. And he actually played the same very heavy accented dark person with bad teeth. When I first watched it, he's the first person I recognized. I'm like, dude, that's Lord Mador. Yeah. So that's the main people in the comedy. In the movie, the guy who plays the grandpa is Denholm Elliott, and he is an actor who specializes in playing slightly sleazy or slightly eccentric roles in older English gentlemen. Although his career has spanned for 40 years, both in Britain and the United States. And he was in World War II. He was a gunner, radio operator. And he was actually shot down in Germany in 1942. And he was a POW. And while a prisoner, he staged various productions in theater constructed out of old packing boxes. So,
wow.
So courageous to do.
And incredible.
After the war, he joined a London company, and Laurence Olivier chose him for the starring role in Venus Observed. He later appeared in another Olivier production, Ring Around the Moon, that was a hit off Broadway. He's appeared in a number of films and was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor for his role as the butler in Trading Places, and received an Academy Award nomination for A Room with a View. And he was in Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
He's such a character actor. You know you've seen him a lot.
Oh.
When I saw him here, I didn't think of it. But then when they say he played the butler in Trading Places, and then I thought, oh, my gosh, he was hilarious.
It's a funny movie.
Yeah.
And that's a Christmas movie. But
it is a Christmas movie, yep.
And also in the movie, Thonny Reeves plays Thomas, little boy, and it appears that this is Thonny's only role on screen, although he did have a long career as a voice actor. He voiced a number of characters in an animated series and films throughout the 80s and 90s, including several anime features. I would also call out a different one, too, in the movie. He plays one of the uncles. His name is Gordon Mastin. He was in Santa Claus. He was in Source Code. He was in The Day After Tomorrow. He's been in so many movies. When I saw him, well, where do I know him from? Both the comedy and the movie are so well acted. I mean, these are phenomenal talents. Let's talk about both these productions. I'll start with the comedy. The comedy is typical British humor. It's really the story about these three brothers who get together every Christmas. And so over the series of three Christmases, the mom and the dad, they have a son. The brother has one son. The uncle has no children, Uncle Godwell. The comedy's told over three different Christmases. Each year is the same thing being told. Right? Christmas Eve, they're making fun of the mom because she's been getting ready since September to have company over. Each year, as she's getting ready, the dad and the boy they're sitting with their feet up with the typical dad face doing nothing. And she always asks him, oh, what are you watching? He'd be like, oh, we're watching Close Encounter of the Third Kind. Oh, what did you think of it? I don't think much of it. The next year, they watch Snowman. What did you think of it? I don't think it's very realistic. Finally, the last scenes, what are you watching? He's like, oh, I'm watching this movie.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. And she's like, what do you think of it? He goes, oh, I quite like it.
Yeah, so, finally he found what he liked. I love that.
Right. Yeah, and so there's sort of these little scenes every Christmas that sort of play out. Are the uncles going to be in time? Are they not going to be in time? Uncle Hugh is the oldest of the three brothers. He's sort of well-to-do. He sells carpeting. He's going through a divorce. He doesn't get along with his son because they're going through the divorce.
He's a braggart.
He's a braggart, right? I was sitting in a hot tub with Tom Jones. And then Uncle Godwell is sort of this guy who's down on his luck. He says, oh, I'm renting a place. I'm living someplace. And they're like, oh, are you renting? Well, not exactly renting. And where are you living? He goes, I'm living in an aquarium. He's sort of still looking for a life to come together for him. But he bets every single year, is it going to snow or not snow? Every year on Christmas Day, he gets up dressed in the most ugliest underwear you'd ever want to see.
And like dirty, too.
Yes. Of course, it doesn't snow for the first couple Christmases. You know, there's also multiple scenes with the choir group coming around every year and singing different Christmas songs. And at the end, they sing, they want to get paid. There's just a series of things that happen. Immensely funny, very British comedy. Each year, Uncle Godwell gets the mom cheese and gets his two nephews a sled. And every year there's some tension. The three brothers, certainly the oldest one, Hugh, and the youngest one, Godwell, don't get along very well. They have the fiercest hungry, hungry hippo battle I've ever seen. But in the end, the last year they're together, it does snow and Uncle Godwell's happy. Why it hasn't snowed much and the snow all melts, they still want to go down the hill. So he greases up the sled and he goes down the hill. And of course, he hits the mother, injures her arm and her leg. At the end, they sort of have this reconciliation amongst them one another. But it is really bust out laughing type of things, and that the whole approach of doing the same scene over again with different outcomes is just really brilliant in humor.
What I loved is the throwbacks occasionally, like the hungry hippo battle.
Right.
There was a fight about that one of the balls was missing. And then the next Christmas, they don't even make a big deal out of it. The mom's cleaning and picks up the ball and like puts it back in the game. It was a funny throwback. But the other thing, Mark, I really loved about it is it takes place during the 80s. So it gives you insight into what we were all experiencing, like the introduction of computer games and how terrible they were at the beginning. But also in Wales, they didn't have a phone and they used a public pay phone that they would walk to instead of having a phone in their house. So that was fascinating as well.
The dad was too cheap to get a phone. Then he also didn't have a color television. But yeah, I mean, there's so many little funny things, like when she reveals to him finally that she hates cheese after years of him buying her cheese. So it's really funny. There's one other thing I want to bring up about A Child's Christmases in Wales. The movie is, think about the poem itself that Dylan Thomas wrote. The movie, it really takes the poem and builds a film around it. And so in there, you have the grandpa and his grandson with his mom and dad. It's Christmas Eve. They're getting ready to wrap it up for the evening. And the little boy wants to open up his Christmas Eve gift. And so his grandfather gives him this beautiful snow globe. The little boy loves it. And he's just so enthralled with it. And then he really is disappointed because it seems to always rain on Christmas Day. And so he asks his grandfather, what is Christmas like when you were a little boy? And that's where Denholm Elliott, as the grandfather, really starts reciting the whole poem of Dylan Thomas. Sort of this recollection of what Christmas in the past was like. It talks about how it snowed all the time, and how there was all this really simple fun that was going around the Welsh town that they lived in, and keeps telling his grandson, who's enthralled with hearing about what the Christmases in the past were like, right? He's almost like jealous, right? Why can't my Christmases be as exciting? The grandfather goes out on these adventures with his best pals. They throw snowballs at the mailman.
And
throw
cats.
Snowballs at the cats, right? They go and sing at you know, sort of like a haunted house type of thing. Yeah. And the little boy is just, you know, hanging on every single word.
I was too. What I was thinking about was, I am more taken with this visual display than I think I would be reading the poem. I was really engaged with this.
You know, what I ended up doing is, so in 1961, Richard Burton, and he's from Wales, he had a TV show where he read the poem. It's like 25 minutes long. I ended up, after I watched these first two movies the first time, I closed my eyes and I listened to him read the poem. And then I went back and I rewatched each of the movies. For me, his description, and then watching, to your point, the visual application of the words in the movie, A Child's Christmas is in Wales, and then watching the comedy, what's interesting is if you listen to the words of Dylan Thomas' poem, and then you watch the comedy version of it, there's seven or eight things from the poem that they incorporated into the comedy.
No way. Seriously?
Yeah.
And now I want to do that. Just the thought of listening to Richard Burton read it, then go back and watch the movie sounds great, but I can't even imagine what carried over between the two at all.
Can I give you some of them? In the poem, they talk about the uncles, how the uncles used to come over every year. The comedy is about three uncles.
That's so obvious. I didn't even think of that.
In the poem, they talk about the blazing pudding and a fire in a tree.
Oh, yeah.
Even the whole thing back and forth with Uncle Gladwell about betting on the snow. They talk about in the poem about how it snows every Christmas. And here's Uncle Gladwell trying to bet on the fact, is it going to snow or not?
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Give you one more. There's a few others. But I won't give you all of them. The other one is at the end of the movie, at the end of the comedy, and at the end of the poem, they talk about the song King Wenceslas.
Is that what the choir group was going to go sing?
Exactly. And that's when the fight starts.
Yes.
When I first watched the comedy piece of it, I didn't even think there was a connection to the original poem, but there was.
I thought the only connection was it was happening in Wales, so they did like a takeoff on the name. Mark, you know what, too? The fact that it's a recollection when telling about what it was like when I was a kid.
That's right. They did incorporate multiple themes from the original poem.
I love learning something that I did not see at all.
So, Bob, were these festive films?
Oh, Mark, I think both of them were festive. Maybe they were festive in the same way. I love them because there's some goofy stuff and there's actually some fighting and sad things too. But overall, they left you with just such a warm, happy feeling. First year, you're like, why do you guys even want to get together? Do you even like each other? Right. Then over the film, you're like, oh, I see. It's the family. It's what they have.
I agree. Definitely a Christmas movie. How did you feel watching them?
I felt nostalgic. I was pining away for a time that doesn't exist anymore, even right. though I didn't live through the time. I don't know if that was the 1800s. I don't. It was more of a feeling like a simpler time kind of thing.
I agree with you about reminiscing. And I think the other thing too about how I felt, this is a relationship with a grandfather and his grandson.
Yes.
The end of the movie, when he's kind of fallen asleep and the grandfather goes to kiss Thomas goodnight, the grandson reaches up and touches his face ever so slightly. And I'm like, oh.
Your heart melts.
Well, are you going to watch this movie again?
A Child's Christmas in Wales, the movie I have seen before, and I watch it. I wouldn't say every year, but I watch it every couple of years. I love to put it on, and I think it just makes me feel like, oh, what Christmas used to be like. And they put it in a way that it's like reliving childhood, kind of. I love that. Yeah. And Child Christmases in Wales, yes, I will definitely watch that again.
Me too. And I would recommend it.
Especially if you grew up in the 80s. Yes. You were young in the 80s. So many things like the hairstyles.
Flock of Seagull haircut, yeah. Waiting for the game to upload. Both are worth.
The funny thing about Wales, it's kind of almost like the place in the UK that you don't hear much about.
That's right. Okay, so how do you say Merry Christmas in Welsh?
Ooh, ready? Good luck.
Thank you. Na dalig Sean.
You got that shh good.
Shh, Sean. I kind of spit. That's why I said the spit guard is on my mic. Welsh is one of the oldest languages in Europe, and it has a rich history and culture. Merry Christmas translates in Welsh to Nadolig Shawin. This phrase is used throughout Wales, both in formal and informal settings, and is most recognized festive greeting in the Welsh language. Nadolig is Latin word for the birth of Christ. Shawin means joyful. So together, they don't translate directly to Merry Christmas, but instead you are wishing someone to experience Christmas joy, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
Which Nadig Shawin is the most common greeting. You also may hear Nadig Hopwis, which is Happy Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Or Carfashian Tamor, which is season's greetings.
Gesundheit?
Carfashian Tamor.
Wow. So I think I'll stick with Merry Christmas.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the traditions. You know, Christmas Eve in Wales used to be known as Noson Galif or Toffee Evening. That's toffee with a T. It was an occasion where friends and families would gather to tell stories and play games and make toffee. We really call it taffy in the United States. Early on Christmas morning, Welsh Protestants would hold a carol service known as plogging. The service would take place at 3 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
And in order to stay awake until that time, slabs of toffee would be made and pulled. Once the toffee had reached a golden yellow color, the strands were cut into small pieces and dropped into ice water to cool. Then the treats were going to be curled into shapes. Noson Galif was also the night for decorating houses with holly and mistletoe before the pre-dawn procession to church began. At 3 a.m., the churchgoers would leave their houses by torchlight or candlelight to go to plogging. The word plogging is thought to have come from plagi, meaning to bend, as in prayer, and the Latin word polycantio, meaning to worship as the cock crows at dawn.
I mean, it's kind of cool thing, but yeah. I'm like, Where did that come from?
That's I wonder if crazy. It was the process, though. It's like, hey, we're going to make taffy tonight, which is going to keep us busy until we go to church at 3 a.m. I don't think I'd ever have faith if my parents said, Mark, we're going to Mass at 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. Oh, I think midnight Mass is hard.
Another tradition, old South Walian tradition that's enjoyed a revival in recent years is Mary Lloyd parading around town. The Mary Lloyd stands for the Grey Mare as a pre-Christian tradition that is thought to bring good luck in the new year. The Mary itself is a horse's skull carried on a long pole by a person under a cloak. It usually has lights or baubles for eyes. A mane is made of colorful streamers of holly and ivy. A white cloak falls from the skull, which is attached to a pole, which is to be held by a person inside. It's kind of a little scary. It is paraded around town, often snapping its bony jaw at you. The traveling party with Mary Lloyd challenged different houses to a battle of wits or to a rap battle known as Finco for food and beer.
Then we're doing it. We're down. Yeah.
Some scholars have linked Mary Lloyd to a legend connected to the nativity story. A pregnant horse was sent out of the stables when Mary arrived to have Jesus, where she spent dark days roaming the land. Others believe the tradition was pre-Christian pagan origin. I never heard that, hey, you'll get out so I can have a baby.
Most of those stories, they're nice. The ones that happened that night, not like, let's kick out the pregnant horse so we can have a baby and that one has to go find someplace else. That seems kind of mean.
I hope that's not true. Let's talk about Santa Claus. Sean Corn is the Welsh version of Santa Claus who lives...
Excuse me? Soin Corn?
Sean. Sean Corn is the Welsh version of Santa Claus who lives in the chimney, brings gifts to well-behaved children. Sean Coyne is literally translated as Chimney Pot John or John Stack, as in corn chimney stack, referencing the way he enters the house via the chimney. His first appearance, it looks to be in 1922. Sean Coyne is described as a benevolent spook who resides up the chimney in comfortable living quarters. According to the book, Mr. Corn ensures that the children go to bed early throughout the year by rewarding those who do with presents at Christmas time.
Did I hear you right? Did you say he lives in the chimney?
He does.
In a comfortable living quarters? That is a huge chimney.
That's what they say, Bob. I don't know.
Okay. Sean Corn.
No, not Sean. Shun.
Sean Corn.
I got to get the slurring going. Another old tradition was the three-week holiday period for farmers called Egoli. All work was suspended during this time. As a symbol of this, the plow was often carried into the home and placed under the table in a room where the meals were eaten. On Christmas Day, there would be a large communal meal of goose or beef at the largest farm in each neighborhood, to which all the farmers were invited. They would eat and drink beer and wet the plow under the table as a reminder that they had not forgotten it.
Now that one I like. 3 weeks off to just eat and drink
beer.
And touch your plow.
And touch your plow.
That sounds kind of dirty.
When you said it, it did. We were okay up until then. And let's talk about some food. At Christmas, you will sample Welsh cakes and berra breth. Welsh cakes are also known as baked stones or pica ramen. Pica ramen are baked goods that are flat, round, and resemble scones. They are traditionally made from flour, lard, sugar, currants, and often a hint of warm spices like cinnamon and mace. They're cooked on a griddle or heavy skillet, which gives them a slightly crispier exterior while keeping the interior soft and tender. Once cooked, they're coated in sugar and served warm. The cakes help sustain Welsh miners since medieval days. These remind me a little bit of the pierogies. Like, I wonder if they stuck them in their pocket.
First thing, I was like, are they tasty? They sounded kind of bland until you got to they coated them in sugar. Then yeah, I'm like, cinnamon. Okay.
They will cut the rolled dough into holiday shapes like trees and stars before cooking them on a hot griddle. That's the Welsh cakes. Yeah. Barra breth is a traditional fruit loaf filled with dried fruits and spices.
Yeah, fruitcake.
Do you like fruitcake?
I'm not a big fruitcake fan.
Yeah, you love it or hate it. The name for this speckled bread, barra meaning bread and breth meaning speckled, is a fitting name for a bread studded with Plump raisins, Bob. Well,
back to the raisins.
The date of the origin is unknown, but it's been around since at least the 18th century and likely earlier, and family recipes are handed down from generation to generation. The Barra Breath is a lighter, easy alternative. It features mixed dried fruits soaked in hot tea, dark brown sugar, and warm mixed spices. Thick slices are delicious when spread with Welsh salted butter.
Mark, I think I counted at least 10 or 11 Welsh phrases you had in there, and you did a great job.
So, guess what?
What?
They have music in Welsh.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
The least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music.
So let's listen to a very popular Christmas song from Wales. So I don't know how we couldn't select the Welsh musician John Cale's song, Child's Christmas in Wales.
Oh my gosh, the third one?
From 1973. Cale was a former member of the Velvet Underground, and the song's inspired by the poem with the same title written by Dylan Thomas, the famous poet. The song has received widespread acclaim from both audiences and critics with its timeless appeal, genuine emotions, and beautifully crafted lyrics. The song has become a Christmas classic that evokes strong feelings of nostalgia as it reflects upon childhood memories. It has a melancholic undertones. The song, it resonates with listeners who are reminded of their own treasured moments and the bittersweet nature of growing old, as well as longing for the fleeting nature of childhood. The song's arrangement includes a variety of instruments, including guitars, piano strings, and a really soft percussion. These choices enhance the intimate ambience of the song.
You know what this tells me? I think people in Wales must love Dylan Thomas's poem because it's in their movies, it's in their music.
Certainly, Dylan Thomas lived a very tortured life and died very young. But probably his most famous poem is Do Not Go Gently Into the Night. Rage, rage against the light. I wonder if it is with this national pride around those poems.
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think you touched on it really well, Bob, earlier. We talked about the nostalgia. Like, do you hope that Louis and other grandchildren, do you want them to ask, you know, Grandpa, tell me about Christmas when you were growing up? Do you want that question?
Oh, I absolutely do. My Christmases were nothing like Dylan Thomas's, but I think I would talk about it in a bigger picture, not specifically my own, but what Christmas was like at the time. Sure, I would love that.
Me too. But like, I even like showing on the map where I lived and where Mimi lived. And we lived in Delaware, and this is where your daddy was born. And I am the same, less about me, but maybe a little bit about maybe some of our family traditions. The other thing I'd say about John Cale, too, if you like the Leonard Cohen song, Hallelujah, listen to John Cale's version. All right, ready for Jingle Belgium?
Jingle Belgium!
Jingle Belgium, jingle Belgium, jingle all the way.
Why would I go to Belgium?
Belgium, Belgium!
In your face, Belgium!
You know, it's funny, Bob, when you named this, right, we talked about Belgium. Because I'm not quite in kindergarten yet, I sort of didn't get like Jingle Belgium. Jingle Belgium. Duh. And I don't think I ever told you this, that when Lena comes over and we're watching her nap routine, we sing her three songs. Each one of us has to take the lead on the song. So she takes the lead on Twinkle Twinkle. And Sue takes the lead on You Are My Sunshine. And you know what the third song is that we sing? Every single time, she gets sung to her every single day, either by us or her parents.
Jingle Bells?
It is.
Really? You're raising her so well,
yeah.
Mark.
That's kind of funny. Papa has to lead us always.
Well, yeah. Lena, this segment goes out to you.
Well, as we begin our exploration of Belgium, we thought about diving into some of the most tasteful aspects of the culture. We figured we could use this episode as an excuse to dine on some waffles and chocolate and maybe wash it down with some Belgian beer. However, we eat all the time, so that might be better saved for later. Sorry, it's not really kickoff material. Then we thought maybe we could go and visit our favorite Belgian Christmas movie location and describe the medieval beauty of Burgess. Again, good, but not the first show. We need to think smaller, more colorful. So we decided to delve into the Belgian creation that has left the whole world feeling blue.
Oh.
We were talking Smurfs.
I love the Smurfs.
Me too. Created by a famous Belgian cartoonist, Peyo, in 1958, the Smurfs have become a global phenomenon. They are one of Belgium's greatest gifts to the world. You can find them in comic books, television shows, movies, toys, lunchboxes, and even other collectible characters to fill an entire mushroom village. So who better to help us Smurf our way through this story than one of the foremost experts on the little blue characters?
Wait, they're experts on these characters?
Of course there are. The Smurfs have remained popular for decades, and in terms of international recognition and cultural influence, are one of Belgium's largest exports. Joining us today is Matt Murray, an acclaimed collector, researcher, and author who has spent years documenting the history and worldwide legacy of the Smurfs. Please welcome Matt to the Festive Foreign Film Fan.
Introducing our Smurfologist. Mark and I were saying we wish we could get a cool title like that. We want to go back to the beginning. We want to know how this all started for you, how you became the Smurfologist.
It starts in 1981. I was 4 years old when the Smurfs cartoon came on. 1981, four-year-old Matt Murray became obsessed with the Smurfs. I love animation. I've always loved animation. I wanted to be an animator. And then I went to film school, and then I became an actor. And I had always collected animation art.
Yeah.
So I would save up allowances and lawn mowing jobs and all this other stuff to buy animation art. I lived in New York at the time. I tuned into a place called the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art, which was a small institution. I started volunteering there. Then what happened was I became an employee. I became their first employee, and I started running the place a little more actively. I wanted to do an exhibition on Saturday morning cartoons, 1966 to 1990, the golden age of Saturday morning. And what happened was I reconnected with those little blue gnomes. And then a lot of memories came flooding back. I started to do a little more research into the Smurfs than I did into other things. So the Smurfs became this kind of thing where I had no idea that the Smurfs dated back to 1950s Belgian comics. I remember seeing in the credits of the Smurfs, Peyo. It's like, what the heck's a Peyo? So I started doing that research, and what I found was, and, you know, this was early 2000s, so there wasn't really a lot of information out there. Even just the things I dug out and some of the tidbits that I found, I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. So in conjunction with the exhibit, which was mounted in New York in 2006, I gave a lecture on Smurfology. I jokingly called myself a Smurfologist. When you're in New York and your local press is Time Out, and you have writers from The Atlantic and Time as your active pool of audience, all of a sudden, stuff like that kind of sticks. One of my bosses at the museum, this guy named Jim Salakrub, he's a cool guy if you're into comics. He started at Marvel as Stan Lee's intern in 1978. And he started his own imprint of comics, his own label called Paper Cuts. And Jim came to my lecture, and based on my lecture, he went after the Smurfs license. This is before the 2011 movie. So the Smurfs were kind of in a hole at this point. And he got the American license, and he sat me down, and he picked my brain. And I became the Smurf consultant on the American relaunch of the Smurfs in comics. My first book, that was The World of Smurfs. When writing that book, I had such a limited pool of info, even though, you know, the rights holders in Belgium gave me stuff, and I was able to pull things out. It's interesting to think of where that book is for me as a writer and information-wise, versus where I'm coming from now, because I'm still doing this 20 years later. We have the Smurf archives going. We're still pumping out material that has never been available in America, and curating that, I'm translating that, and I'm writing the historical essays. And there are a couple other projects that I'm talking about with a few publishers that will be available over the next couple of years, because it's Peyo, Pierre Culliford's 100th birthday in 2028. And that coincides with the 70th anniversary of the Smurfs. I loved it as a kid. I became a Smurfologist as a joke. But then what happened was the joke became real. over my career, the Smurfs have always just been kind of this undercurrent and wave going throughout my life.
You started out tongue-in-cheek, but it grew into something really serious.
Did people seek you out? Was there some longing for information for that place like Comic-Con?
I've spoken at a few Comic-Cons. I've spoken at a museum. I've spoken at libraries. I've spoken at many places about the Smurfs. There is this kind of cycle that pop culture goes through where every 30 years, people go digging back through the past. 2006, you're looking at 25 years since the Smurf cartoon had been on. So it was due for its comeback in America. This stuff never went away in Europe. In Belgium, a Smurf is Mickey Mouse. They're omnipresent. They're all over the place. Germany, at the absolute bottom point of Smurf popularity, they were still publishing a widely popular Smurf magazine that put out new comics every month. The first Smurf was published in 1958. Europe, they're legitimately all ages. It's considered an honest art form where here, we're still fighting for that legitimacy. America doesn't get that in the way that Europe does, especially in France and Belgium. Almost part of the Belgian identity at this point.
Is Belgium like a hotbed for comics?
It was back in the 60s. I mean, you know, it was like the golden age of Belgian comics. Asterix is more French, but the artists were Franco-Belgian. Tintin? People forget how friggin' huge Tintin is in the rest of the world and how big it was when it came out in the 30s and 40s. It had a resurgence in the 60s. They had that Steven Spielberg movie and Peter Jackson's doing another one. And that's another one of those things where it has its moments. As far as America goes, when you get into comics culture, you really start to get into like people who actively read stuff beyond the superhero scope, beyond what's popular. Tintin is something that people bring up regularly. I mean, Tintin's the inspiration for Indiana Jones, which is why when Spielberg made that movie, people were like, he's the perfect guy to make Tintin. If you look at the boulder chase in Indiana Jones, it's right out of a Tintin comic. I'm a comics and cartoon historian. They have several comics museums there. Tintin, Asterix. So, I mean, these things are all part of that identity, and there's other comics and cartoonists, like a guy named Franquin, who was one of Peo's best friends and collaborators.
So when you say groundbreaking, how were they groundbreaking?
Because it moved the demographic. It moved the demographic younger. The audience is always considered youth. But the thing is, the adults read them too. What made his stories interesting were that he had very adult themes in these stories presented through Little Blue Gnomes. There's elections and language war and what were contemporary Belgian sociopolitical issues that these adult writers and artists found a way to filter into this comic. Peo and Delporte, his writing partner, they lived through the Nazi occupation of Belgium. That's what they grew up in. Even though Peo didn't consciously have that kind of political bent, Delporte did. But I mean, it's kind of hard not to look at a comic like The Smurf King or King Smurf, depending on whatever translation you read, right? Where a guy essentially is elected and then becomes a despot and takes over what could be perceived as a socialist village. It's kind of hard not to see that as some kind of allegory. You remember, they've been around for 70 years and they've been through all these different incarnations. And a lot of the controversy comes when they come to America. They're Satanist because there's magic involved. They're communist because they live in a perceived socialist utopia. And their leader wears red and has a beard. They're sexist because of Smurfette, or they're not sexist because of Smurfette, or the black Smurfs. The black Smurfs are what happens when the Smurfs get bitten by a fly and they're infected. It's the first solo Smurf story, comes out in 1959. It predates zombie movies by a decade. But the funny thing is, if you read the black Smurfs, it is a George Romero zombie movie. They go around, they turn black, and they munch each other, and there's been different stories about whether or not the black color was because it's the Black Plague. We're not all that familiar with, but it's a big thing in Europe. It wiped most of their ancestors out. And there's a thing about, well, you know, black is the color of magical evil, and stuff, so they become black. Not like African-American black, or not like brown black, jet ink black. And that's what it is. And they become nonverbal, and they go, nah, 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 and they bite each other. I've been writing an essay about this. I've written many about this one. This one in Smurfette always comes up. This was not allowed outside of Belgium or outside of French-speaking countries for decades.
Because it was perceived as racist?
Because the modern market just hears black, sees black, thinks instantly, this is about race. Doesn't matter. For better or for worse, that's the society that exists. So what happened was they shelved it, but then when they brought the Hanna-Barbera cartoon out in 81... In that first episode, Hanna-Barbera, they called an audible. They turned him purple. So that became the Purple Smurfs. And then all of a sudden, there were more things out there about the Purple Smurfs. They released a record album and they did a little bit of marketing. But then again, it kind of faded, fizzled away again. Here's the thing. They literally just turned black to purple. They just said, you know what? Fine, not black, purple. Same story. Same thing. Oh. Just not black, purple. Now they're making like Funko Pops of them and stuff like that. That was a controversy. You lose more by covering up or ignoring some of the messier part of history just because you're uncomfortable with it. Yeah. Like the black Smurfs, or there's another thing, the Swoofs, or even elements of Smurfette. If you say that those things didn't happen, you're doing a disservice to history itself.
You said you're also always asked about Smurfette.
Why is Smurfette the only girl in the village? It spins off into a whole discussion of Belgian culture. Remember, she was created in 1964, 63, right? There really is that kind of sexist of women belong in a certain place. So you can't escape that. That's history. The Smurfs really weren't as controversial until they became an American phenomenon. They were hugely popular in Europe. They had their things here and there. But once they hit the American shores, like anything else, you gotta have your controversies. Growing up, the Smurfs were kind of a defining movement phenomenon for my generation. That cartoon was designed to infect my brain. And a lot of that has to do with the original comics and Peyo. When you look at what else was on the market at the time, it really was designed to take over Saturday morning cartoons, which were the church of my generation. 1966 to 1990, you knew where every child was Saturday morning. They were in front of their television. It's the evolution of society and how we entertain. That's the way society's progressed, and it's kind of a moment preserved in an era. The last great shared thing happens within my generation, Gen X. The new millennium shifts, and the way we take things in, the way we enjoy ourselves, the way we interact with each other changes. Saturday morning starts with superheroes, and then it becomes teenagers, Scooby-Doo, the Archies. And then it kind of falls into this lull where they're repackaging their old characters. So you got Scooby-Doo's Laugh Olympics, where you have Scooby-Doo and Yogi Bear and the Dune Buggy and Jabberjaw and everybody else competing in these things or chasing each other or like wacky races. So that's the late 70s environment. And then you have a little bit of flare-up again with superheroes. And then the Smurfs happen. And the Smurf sets the bar lower in terms of age. Now you're not just appealing to the 8 to 12-year-old. We're like, I'm going to be cool and solve mysteries with a shark. Or I'm going to run around with the Funky Phantom and his ghost kitty cat and solve mysteries. Or I'm going to compete in Battle of the Network Stars, which is essentially what like Laugh Olympics was. No, no, no. Here's this thing where it's a fantasy story. Again, 1980s, big fantasy. Yeah. With these little blue adorable characters. And the kids tap into the language. And they start speaking Smurf. I literally am writing a linguistics essay at an academic level about the language of Smurf right now, where you can replace words, parts words, with Smurf, and they just did it for fun, and then try to build a set of rules around it. You just took out half the words and replaced them with Smurf.
I used to watch my nephews and nieces, I was in my early 20s, not married, and the Smurfs were one of the few cartoons that were on the approved list. I remember watching them and just there's enough adult topics to make you interested. The kids are being entertained by these cute little blue things. I would sit there and watch Smurfs with them all the time. I fell in love with them even though I was 22 years old.
Some of those themes you were talking about from Belgium, political themes, did those carry over into America?
They did, but, you know, they sanded the edges off of the cartoons.
Yeah.
There were whole, you know, standards and practice divisions sitting there sanding the edges off of these things. I mean, you can still see the DNA. It's inescapable. Especially since Peyo, in his contract, which was uncommon, had a lot of veto power over the Hanna-Barbera cartoon. He had a lot of approvals. Because they tried to change the heck out of it. They're like, this is never going to work for an American audience. This fantasy thing set in a European forest. And how about we set it in Central Park? And Jokey is Harpo Marx. And there's drawings that exist of Jokey Smurf in a Harpo Marx wig dressed as Harpo Marx. And what if instead of all being blue, they're all the different colors that embody their personality? There was some infighting and some discussions that went on between Peyo and Hanna-Barbera. And then ultimately it just came down to, wait, contractually, Peyo wins. Especially in the early days and the first few seasons, they were pretty rigorous about what made it to air. And I mean, you know, there are rumors they wanted to do spinoffs and take these things into weird directions. And he's like, nope.
What do you think causes them to resurface on the cycles? Is it nostalgia?
Here's the thing. They're constant. They've been going for 70 years. It's just who's paying attention. at one point in the 90s, they didn't even have a magazine in their home country, but Germany had a magazine that sold very well and kept them alive. And that magazine ran for like 200 issues.
It's stunning when you think there's international appeal there.
It goes back to foundationally, they are a lot more sound than what most other children's properties had. There is that generational foundation of the comics dating back to 1958 and being huge then. There's always somebody who's going to carry it forward. Sometimes it's more in Europe or sometimes it's more in South America. They had a Paramount movie that came out last year. People just need to keep on digging back to something that's already proven. A lot of times they take a property because it has a name and then strip it of everything but the name. And that will sink the property. And then it pops back up again 10 years later. People saying, hey, let's give this another shot. They got it wrong last time. Let's figure it out again. I think that's part of it, too. The commercial viability of it. We know the Smurfs are commercially viable. The executive will look back and be like, in 1981, more people watched the Smurfs than watched Dallas, which was the highest rated primetime television show. That is kind of the way that Hollywood works to an extent when they want to resuscitate a property. The property itself has continued. Whether we're aware of it in America, it has persisted in one way or another for almost 70 years now. So there is always a wealth of material feeding what can be adapted or what can be sold, which also makes it a little more appealing to an executive who wants to buy it and make something else of it.
Is it ongoing in Belgium?
They don't have a current Smurf magazine, but they do release books every year. There's also a spinoff of the property with girl Smurfs called the Smurfies. Even though Smurfs are their kid stuff, most of my market that I'm aware of, the people who come to me, the people who send me letters and emails and texts, are adult collectors who grew up with it. Most conversations I have about Smurf fandom are on an adult level. I actively have participated in 15 books that you could go on to either eBay or Amazon and purchase. There's another 10 to 15 in the next 2 years. It's frustrating sometimes because people, oh, look, it's the Smurf guy. But it's such a great property. It's had such a positive effect on people's lives. It brings joy to masses of people. Who gets to do that? To share that on a larger global scale with people. It's taken me to places like it opened doors for me I never imagined. Whatever I can give back to them in terms of contributing to the history or exposing the history or translating and bringing that to new generations, I'm all for that. I'm all in on that. I love it. I know this is about Belgium. I'm going to make a couple of reading recommendations for you guys. A couple of things that are aimed directly at Belgian history. Mm-hmm. And one, of course, is the King Smurf, or Smurf King, depending on what we're calling it that week. It's not a direct Hitler allegory, I've been told. Not allowed to use that. No, I think it was. But it does show what happens when elections come to the village and an authoritarian comes to power. And there's a lot of stuff about the Belgian Fifth Column in there. If you're a history fan, that's one. Wow. Also, you got to remember Belgium, of course, has the whole culture war going on about what is the language of Belgium. Is it German or is it French? And right. Back in the 70s, this actually hit like a boiling point. And the answer to that from Payon Delporte was a comic that we call Smurf versus Smurf. For them, it's Smurf Green versus Green Smurf. It factors in the language. Where do you use the word Smurf? Is it Smurf Green or Green Smurf? And it causes a border dispute. And if you look at Belgian history, that's part of Belgium's history. What's our national identity? Is our national identity the French side or the German side? And so they explore that. How people speak is like, well, you speak like that, so you're from the north. You speak like that, you're from the south. I hate you. I hate you. War. And if you just like adventure comics, it's actually a Johan and Pee-wee comic called A Cursed Country that has the Smurfs in it. And that's probably my favorite Smurfs comic. It's everything that the Smurfs franchise, I believe, could be if handled correctly. I think the Smurfs, when handled correctly, is Lord of the Rings for kids. So if you look at The Cursed Country, I think that is an amazing foundation for where the Smurfs could go. And that comes from the 60s. If you want to read, those are my recommendations for dipping your toe into the Smurfs.
Well, you've been incredible. Wow. Anything you want to promote that's going to be coming out soon for our listeners?
Well, on the shelf right now, there's a series called Smurfs Archives, where we're presenting the original comics in publishing order. And there's a lot of cool stuff in those. Volume 5 just came out, and we have through Volume 8 scheduled. Volumes 5 and 6 get a lot into what we're talking about with the whole Belgium thing, how Belgium celebrates April Fool's Day, a lot of the customs like king cakes and the cultural history of Belgium and whether or not it's culturally Catholic. A lot of that stuff's discussed in there. And Volume 5 just came out. Volume 6 is coming out in March. And those two together really focus on a lot of the Belgian questions that I was talking about. Yep. Volume 1 has both versions of the Black Smurfs in it, both the Black Smurfs and the Purple Smurfs. Volume 2 has some fun stuff in it. Volume 3 really unearthed old material. Volume 4, I got the Marvel Smurf comics. I found the original print material and convinced everybody to reprint them. So like the Smurf Treasury Edition was back in print for the first time in 40 years with Volume 4. Volume 5 is Smurf Magazine, a lot of the Belgian questions and Belgian cultural history. Volume 6 kind of brings that in. Paper Cuts, the Smurfs Archives. And they're big hardcovers.
You've been incredibly generous with your time and your energy. And we're so excited to have the Smurfologist, Matt Murray.
I'm the world's most dangerous Smurfologist. Let's put it that way.
You're the only Smurfologist.
Guys, thank you very much for the invite. Thanks. This has been a lot of fun. I hope your listeners enjoy this.
I think I might be elevated amongst my nephews and nieces when I tell them who I talk to.
Hey, have a Smurfy day.
You too.
Smurf expert.
Wow.
Right? Who knew? Well, we're getting near the end of the show. I think it's time that we start talking about some trivia.
It's trivia.
Trivia.
What is amazing is when you consider the United Kingdom, you hear a lot about England and Scotland and Ireland. But when you get to Wales, well, it doesn't get much attention. A small country tucked away and overlooked, but don't let it fool you. Wales may be small on the map, but it has a remarkable history. For example, we thought about testing about how Wales was the motor behind the Industrial Revolution. It has an extraordinary concentration of natural resources like ore, coal, limestone, and copper, all in close proximity. So it became one of the world's largest centers of iron making, coal mining, and copper smelting.
Did you know that before this show?
No.
Then isn't it amazing that little country was supplying all of the material? That's wow.
Yeah, or we considered quizzing you on how two mathematical symbols, the equals sign and the pi sign, were invented and popularized by Welsh mathematicians.
I'm happy to celebrate Pi Day, March 14th.
We wanted to examine you about how the Welsh call their own country Cymru, because Wales is an old English word meaning foreigner or stranger.
So everybody else calls them foreigners and strangers. That is so funny. So they have their own name for their country. Wow.
Right. We even thought to ask you to pronounce the name of the village, Clon V Pluthgwyn Gluthgura Fadrabuth Luntusilu Guga Gak.
Can you repeat that?
Sure. Clon V Pluthgwyn Gluthgur Yiru Thundra Bluthra Ti Sila U Go Go Gak, which is one of the longest names for a place in the world. The name translates to mean St. Mary's Church in the hollow of the White Hazel near a rapid whirlpool and the Church of St. Tassilio near the Red Cave. But gosh, I will get you back for having me read this. Instead, we decided to focus on one unique feature of the flag of Wales. It is considered one of the most distinctive and recognizable flags in the world because of what it has on it. If you know it, tell us, and we'll present you with the real engine of progress, the 4F sticker. So you got to tell us what makes the Wales flag so recognizable.
So unique.
Whereas history may have been powered by iron, coal, and copper, our podcast is powered by stickers. They are little adhesive circles with unlimited motivational potential, and like Wales, are far more weightier than the size would ever suggest.
Oh, those 4F stickers always sound just incredible to me.
So my quote tonight is from John Greenleaf Whitten. He's a poet. Somehow, not only for Christmas, but all the long year through, the joy you give to others is the joy that comes back to you.
Oh, I like that. We're on a poetry streak here.
We are. I want Richard Burton to read every poem I ever want to listen to.
Like, well, and I really want to do what you did. I think that sounds great. Listen to him read the poem, yeah, then watch the movie again. That's a great idea.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. The other thing, too, when Richard Burton does the poem on TV, he's standing up and he's standing at a bar and he's holding a beer. He takes the beer in his hand and he walks over and he sits down and he keeps reading it. Then he stands up, gets the beer, and brings it back to the bar. He never takes a sip of the beer.
He just carries it around with him.
These things bother me, Bob. Next time, we're off to Central Asia. Our next film is a documentary that takes us to the rugged celestial mountains of Kyrgyzstan, where one man has embraced the true spirit of Father Christmas. Dicing with Death, the Father Christmas of Kyrgyzstan explores the lengths one person will go to spread joy in a brutal and unforgiving landscape. You can find this movie on YouTube.
Wow, that sounds intense.
All right, I'll leave you with a poem.
Can you read this in your best Richard Burton voice?
Give me a minute. From the emerald hills to the rugged shores, where the ancient rivers flow, a land abundantly blessed by God that helped the world to grow. With coal and iron and stone and strength, your wonders never fail. Though quiet on the world map, forever proud is Wales.
Oh, I've been standing up with my hand on my heart.
So, hey, do you want me to actually play how you pronounce that city?
Yes. Sorry. Do you have that?
So I tried my best, but this is how it really is pronounced.
Oh, I thought you did a good job.
Well, we'll see. All right, ready?
Yeah.
Glanvarpeth Gwingith Gagareth Wendroveth Linda Cilia Go Go Go.
Get?
Yeah.
Gwingith Gagareth Wendroveth Linda Cilia Go Go Go.
Sure. I'll have what she's having. Good night, Mark.
Actually, we're done.
Done, done.
It's over. Over, over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.